or I have to question is having three martinis too much? Well, if you ask the question, that means it's probably too much.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Yes, I'm Still Sober with John Rabin. It's episode 7. Episode 7. All right. Thanks for joining me. I hope you're doing all right. Fine. I hope you're doing fine-ish, at least. Status quo. It's 98 degrees outside, which after a month of 100 degree plus temperatures, like 98, it's like, that's not bad. It's nice. It's all in perspective, I guess. So I've got a thing I'm going to do for today's episode, and I'll get to that in a second. But at work last week, one of the servers, this younger dude, he took like the head cook for the shift aside and was like, I don't know what to do. I think I got the check back to the customer a little late, and they were upset about it. I think we're gonna get a bad Yelp review. And the cook goes, all right, thanks. The fuck? And it was adorable. Man, can you imagine being in a spot in your life where a bad Yelp review is concerning? That must be nice. Must be really, really nice. Or not, to think that there's any, that's even a thing anymore. If you want to make the world a better place and you don't want to do a lot of anything, if you want to lazily make the world a better place, stop posting on Yelp. Yeah, stop using it altogether. Close your account if they even let you. Don't go on the website. You want to look at there are places you're getting reviewed on Facebook and Google anyway. You don't need those extorting pricks anymore. And quit using it as a move, because the mob mentality, outrage. We're going to get them on Yelp. Fuck Yelp. Fuck that as a tactic. Anyway, forget them, man. I want to see them go down. And that would be that that would be the best. So today, what I'd like to do is I would like to call this episode How I Eventually Finally at the Last Minute Got Sober. Because that's the most accurate way to describe it. And because I've told like bits and pieces on different interviews, different podcasts, different types of shows, but never really given a timeline, and I figure of all places to talk about it, this would be the place to do it. And so, in case you're curious, let me preface this with two things. First, I'm not recommending my particular method of getting sober. I wouldn't recommend this to anybody, really. Number two, just because I like being honest. I like being able to say AA didn't work for me because I thought I was too smart for it. But I don't like the idea of putting something in somebody's head that like, yeah, maybe I'm too smart for it too. No, you should probably really do it. Like, that's the easiest way to go, is to go through AA. Because it's established, there's lots of yahoos already there, so you have a support system, even, you know, regardless. Just remember that just because somebody is sober doesn't make them a good person. They might be a shitty person, only now they're sober, so they're just kind of less shitty. Like controlled shittiness versus just out of control shitty. So keep that in mind. Don't date anybody in AA. Don't. Yeah. You know, predators, don't do it. But just keep in mind that's, you know, don't, the higher power thing, don't let it bug you. In fact, there are people in the program that like They're like, all right, just ignore it and just go through the thing, because they haven't updated all the shit yet. It's 90 years old, this program, without any update in language or concepts. Because I'm like, oh, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Well, it is kind of, it's not broken, but it's not a smoothly oiled machine. But now, just realize that the whole idea of a higher power is something bigger than yourself, because yourself alone can't be sober, can't sober up, because if you're at that point, hasn't been working. So the idea is to get out of, to get out of the fact that you can't do this alone, even though you can, but it's all in your brain. So you have to fix that. You need help in order to get to a spot where you actually can do it, because it is you. I don't think that helped. That's fine. But that's just keep that in mind. Don't immediately dismiss AA unless it just doesn't work for you, or unless you're stubborn and you think you're too smart for everything. And now, if you're that way, if you're like me, then yeah, you've got to figure out another way to go, or find a 12-step program that's run by atheists. There are some out there, unless you're like in the Midwest or some place that's if you're in Oklahoma, good luck finding an atheist group. But this is what happened for me. So we'll start, I guess. All right, so timeline. So I was a nice professional drunk for many years, arrested a total of 8 times. That's 3 DWIs, 4 public intoxication arrests, and then the 8th arrest was basically revoking my probation, where I had to turn myself back in, and we'll get to that in a second. So I was doing that, and then and then I started doing, I started kind of experimenting with different opiates, different pills, and then moved into heroin, me and my girlfriend at the time. And that was in 2008 is when I started doing that. And I was doing both. I was going out and drinking and also doing heroin, kind of alternate, because I wasn't doing heroin all the time, but I was, just playing around with it. And then I was doing both. And like I've said before, you can't drink and do heroin because you tend to die a lot. So I had to pick one. So that was the first time I quit drinking, was so I could just do heroin. So that was in 2008. Now we're going to skip ahead to 2010, which is I finally had to... I did this outpatient program in 2010, and because I had like too many breathalyzer violations on my car, so I did an outpatient program about it for probation. Made me do that, and at that point, I actually tried to do. Now, I had been going to AA meetings all this time, on and off, because they required me with probation, you're supposed to sign a card. Of course, then I figured out that I didn't have to just go to those meetings. I could just take my, AA card to open mics and having comedians sign my card, because it's anonymous. They can't fucking check that shit. So I started doing that for a little bit. But in 2010, I actually tried to work the steps for a bit. And I started to, and I tried sobriety, and I made it just under 30 days at that point. And then another time I tried it, and I made it on and off a week to 2 weeks to whatever. And I would, I got so used to quitting, because here's the craziest part. The 3 years that I did heroin, I was on felony DWI probation. I was a junkie while being on probation for alcohol. You know how fucking insane that is? And yet that's what I was doing. So I got to this point where I would quit 3 days before I'd go into my meeting, because it gets out of your system within 72 hours. for the most part. And of course, I don't know if you've seen me, but I'm not a big person. So like, yeah, so my metabolism, like it, yeah, 3 days, that was it. It would totally get out of my system. So I got so used to withdrawals, like it, you know, withdrawals can on some drugs can kill you. On for heroin, withdrawals are fucking terrible. They're just, it's insane. If you've ever seen Trainspotting, it's crazy. But but I got so used to it. It was just like a thing, well, I'm just going to be sick and gross and just going to do this. And it was just, it's just fucking terrible. So I would do that and I got so used to doing that. So then I finally, in 2011, was it? Oh, 2010. So incidentally, if you go to YouTube, I don't know if they're still on there. Because they're not my videos. They're like other people have taken videos of me. So you can actually find videos of me on YouTube. And there's like two different shows you can find. And they're in the same year. And it's fucking crazy to look at. Because one video was during the month that I wasn't doing drugs. And as a goof, I'm wearing khakis and like a button-up shirt. And my glasses. And I'm all clean-shaven. Because I thought it would be crazy to do a contrast for what I'm looking like. So I think that's still out there. I don't know if that's still up. And then just a few months later, then they're doing a benefit show for me because I had gotten an infection, cellulitis in my hand or in my arm for reusing my same needles all the time that ended me up in the hospital for 2 weeks, big infection. And so I had all these hospital bills and they did a fundraiser for me at the Velveeta Room. And so there's video of me performing at that show and I look like fucking Lane Staley. I don't look good at all. Holy shit. Like it was in November, but so it's cold, but still I'm all bundled up and I've got, you know, I'm unshaven. It's the worst I've looked. I can tell you that much. So that's on there as well. It's very strange. That benefit show was the way that I justified it. The money for the benefit show helped me pay rent. Like I didn't use any of it for drugs because I could barely scrape by. So and like that in my head was the good thing. The right thing to do was to not use that money. Because I didn't have a job, so I was unemployed, and the funny part about the benefit was it was supposed to help with medical bills and other bills, which I used it for other bills because the medical bills for 2 weeks in the hospital was $200,000. That's nuts. I didn't pay a single dime of that 200 grand. I'm just sorry, didn't do it. Also, side note, that reminds me, I got my bill from Seton from the. Cutting the tip of my finger off is $2,000. They didn't even give me any drugs. They gave me a tetanus shot, but it's $2,000. It was there less than an hour. I mean, they helped me out and cut it down to $1,000. I owe them $1,000, and I'm going to send them probably $10 a month. That's what I'm going to do. That's my healthcare plan, is I'm going to send you $10 a month so that you don't send me to collections. And then, you know, I'll just go, you know, who's your primary care physician? Whoever's working the ER that night. So anyway, but I am sending the money. So yeah, so that was the thing, is they did a benefit show and it was for a few hundred dollars. I got a few hundred dollars. It's a totally different world with people with their GoFundMes making thousands of dollars. You know, my dog's sick, thousands of dollars. But, you know, medical bills, in person, like a fundraiser in person, that's never. It's a different world back then, 2010. So, sorry, I'm getting off track here. Hang on first. All right, so... Because I was a strung out junkie, I couldn't get a job. I just wasn't able to. I was not able to interview well or even go to interviews. So I ended up finally bailing on Austin and I went back and stayed at my dad's house in Seguin for a little bit. I did get a job at the coffee shop, at a coffee shop in Seguin, and I stayed there and was sober for 1 month until, on a whim, I decided I would go back to Austin, made contact with a dealer, and bought heroin and came back and got high and OD'd. And I was OD'ing, and I've OD'd several times. The thing about an overdose, people usually think of an overdose when it ends up, when people either die or they have to go to the hospital or be revived. That's not what an overdose is. If you take a drug and it makes you pass out, not nod off, but like you lose consciousness, because it's, that's an overdose. And by that definition, over the 3 years of doing heroin, I OD'd a lot. Like, I don't have a number for you. But I've been revived a few times. And it sucked every single time. But I OD'd at my dad's house, and for some reason, because I was supposed to go to work, and my dad decided he'd give me a ride to work, even though it was only a few blocks. And he found me unresponsive, and my dad actually revived me, and then I ended up in the hospital, you know, then paramedics came. So that was one of those weird things where he never gave me a ride to work, but thought, I'll stop by and give him a ride to work, and brought me back. So it was at that point that they confronted me in the hospital. My parents were divorced, but I came to, and both my mom and my dad were in the same room together and looking at me, and sat me down, and, well, sat me down. I was already in the bed, in a hospital bed, but, and they just, and the thing was, is that I couldn't, so I couldn't stay there anymore. What I had to do is I had to get help. And at the time, and I don't think this program even still exists, but there was a program in Texas that funded rehabs for pregnant women who are addicts and needle users. And I was one of those two things. So I actually qualified for the grants that they were giving, and was able to get into a rehab facility in San Antonio that would normally have been way too expensive. It's like thousands and thousands of dollars, but they was able to pay for me. And so that's what I did. So in February of 2011, I went to a 90-day rehab program. And I wanted to just stop for a second, because a friend of mine who listens to the podcast had commented on my Facebook and had a question, you know, had some questions, and it's, let's see, she says, I've heard you talk about your parents many times and how well you were raised. I'm curious to know when they first learned about your addictions and ways they helped that were useful. And then later is like, so what are things that people did that were helpful to you? How can people who love an addict help them? Is tough love really the only answer? And of course, I can only speak for myself, but I can tell you that money, you know, don't give the money that you probably already know that. But I always played down for my parents. They didn't, I wasn't around them. So, you know, I always played down what exactly was going on with me. Like, they knew that there were some things up, but they didn't know anything about, until that overdose, they didn't know I was a heroin addict. And they really didn't know the extent, but I wouldn't have gone to rehab had it they not given me the ultimatum that it was either this out on the street or go to rehab. That was getting put in a position of where it was this or that was finally what did it. That's what got me there. That and the funding, obviously, which I'm going to, for next week, I think, or in the next couple of weeks, whenever I find out the information, I'm going to let you know about any kind of, see if there are still programs that help pay for rehab out there for people, because I haven't looked. That'd be interesting to know, considering the opioid crisis is even worse than it was in 2010. But that's, yeah, I think that, I don't know, that for me was getting put, I had to get put in a corner where I didn't have any other options to, I can do, you know, I'll be fine. Like, just keep going. I think that you'll find out later that came up again, that, well, it's either that, you know, I've got no other choice. And that's basically what it took for me, is it took, I don't know if it was like an ego thing where it's like, look, I've never been, you know, I'm a junkie, but I've been on probation the whole time. Look how clever I am. I'm making it. I can still, you know this sucks, but I don't want to sober up because this is how I don't know what was going on. I really don't. It's foggy in my head. I just a completely different person. I just felt dead on the inside. So I went to rehab for 90 days, February, and I stayed in San Antonio. So I stayed in San Antonio for a couple of years. And when I got out of rehab, during rehab, we did the steps, and the steps went all the way. And every time I've done this, and I did it twice, two times I seriously did the steps, and both times I got to the very, to the make amends step. And I hate that step, because making amends should be something that you want to do out of guilt when you realize what you've done, and then you go, look, I got to make it up to this person. But if there's something really disingenuous about doing this, like, hey, I just wanted to say I'm sorry because I'm making amends, and I don't know, it's on the step. The steps say I have to say I'm sorry. So anyway, I wanted to say I'm sorry. It's disingenuous, man. It just doesn't feel right. So I never went past the steps past that point, because it just, like, look, I'm going to make things better, you know, when I can, versus doing it because it's like, well, this is what the instructions say. It just didn't feel right. So rehab worked for me in that it helped me quit heroin. However, I was in San Antonio and I didn't have anything to do, I felt. So I eventually started drinking again. Because, you know, well, at least it's drinking this time. That was kind of my thought process. It's like, well, it's drinking. It's not the same. So, and if you've ever been in San Antonio, like we say in Austin, that, you know, well, you know, this is a heavy drinking city. It is. But in San Antonio, that's the only thing to really do. Like Austin, you've got other things. There's lots of activities. You don't have to drink to do those activities. We do, but there's lots of activities. In San Antonio, there's just way less of all that shit to do and just as much drinking. Drinking's more of a, look, we've got things that we might be able to do while we drink. So it was just, yeah. And that's when I started washing dishes, because I couldn't find a job. And I wasn't good at interviews, because I had realized up to this point in my life, you know, 30 plus years, almost 40 years of my life, I've never gotten a job because of an interview. I got a job because of knowing somebody. And so I just was terrible at interviews until I walked into Trade Trattoria in San Antonio. And for the dish position, and there was a guy right before me. I was waiting for him to get done with the interview, and his interview, he had experience with dishwashing, but he couldn't start till the next day. He's like, I can't start today, but I could start tomorrow. And I'm like, all right, thank you. And I walk in for my interview, and the guy goes, can you start today? I went, yeah. All right, you're hired. End of interview. That was it. Oh, so I started washing dishes and I sucked at it. Kicked my ass for 2 days in a row. I was terrible. And I finally, I had guys that were jumping in the dish pit to help me and kind of watching them. And they were teaching, oh, you don't have to spend too long scrubbing. You're not at home washing dishes. This is some, you know, this is a big machine. You just got to get this stuff off, and it's all about speed and I finally figured it out after day three, and then I've been washing dishes ever since because I fucking love the job. But I was working around restaurant people, and it's just booze is around. You drink. That's what you do. Everybody gets off work, you go drink. And so that's what I did. I started drinking and I was fine for a while. But because I was a major alcoholic, it doesn't take long. You're right back into blacking out and doing crazy shit again. So I was not doing very well. But I was better because I wasn't, but it felt like I was okay because I wasn't doing heroin, right? So I'm like, no, it's okay. I'm, you know, everybody else is drunk around me too. And, you know, this is just crazy shit happens. You know, this is what we do. And so then I got arrested for public intoxication at my 20-year high school reunion, which is hard to do because it's a town of 5,000 people. And yet I pulled it off. So because of that, I was on felony probation. And when you get arrested while you're on felony probation, you're going to get your probation revoked. And that's when... And I was lucky because I had this bike riding Buddhist probation officer, real Zen woman who wasn't really supposed to do this, but she did. She called me when I was talking to her. She goes and she said, look, they put out a warrant for your arrest. So you should go turn yourself in. But before you do that, you should probably make plans because they're not going to tell you they're going to arrest you. They're going to make an appointment for you at your probation office and say, yeah, we're going to talk through and, you know, work out and see what you can do. At that meeting, you will be arrested and taken to jail. And then they'll eventually figure out what you're going to do in jail. And I guess they do that because they don't want people to run away or not show up. But it's also kind of bullshit that they won't tell you so that you can't get things taken care of. But luckily, this woman helped me out. So she's awesome. So it was like I was planning to go away for a while. Like I took care of all, I wrote a rent check to my roommate way in advance, you know, for the next month, because I thought that I might be in jail for a month. I didn't know how long I was going to be. But just in case, I had my stuff ready. So if my dad had to come grab all my stuff, it'd be easy to do. I kept everybody. I told my job that, you know, I was going to be gone for a bit. And I didn't know what was going to happen. I made sure everything was fine. And then I went to, then my mom drove me on her birthday. I had to turn myself in on her birthday. So I made my sobriety date on her birthday, which is September 12th. And I actually had quit drinking before that. I finally quit drinking. It was just the last straw kind of thing. And then I found out I had to turn myself in after I'd been sober for a couple of weeks. And I was like, oh, but I'm not drinking now. That's going to be enough. Travis County's going to go, oh, really? Well, never mind then. You're cool. So no. Here's the reason I quit, because I finally drank myself out. It took a 1-2 punch. I had one night where I just, drunk dialed people, because that's what you did. Still, we texting hadn't really taken over, so I was still drunk dialing a little bit, and I saw like the list of a couple of numbers, you know, drunk dialing friends and talking to people at 2 a.m. and a bunch of other dumb shit. And it was just, that was like, I was like, all right, you know what? I'm done. This is too, you know, and it was just one, looking at my call list and not remembering it and looking at it going, oh man, like I could delete, you know, and then immediately deleting the records of who I call. See, it does, it's no longer a thing. That didn't happen. But I just, it sat on me, and then the very next, on that very next day, and then that day I had gone to the bar that I liked, and I was having a beer, and I was just kind of looking at it going, no. No. And I didn't even finish the beer. That was it. I went home, and I was thinking about it going, this is it. I'm done. That's, no more. I drank myself out. That's, you know, I'm 39 years old. That was enough. I think it was 38 at the time. 39. Yeah, 2012. So that was, you know, just right before I turned 39. So I just realized, I was like, no, I've had enough. That's. Now, had I not gone to jail, I don't know how long I would have kept that up. So I go. So my mom takes me on her birthday. So that's the thing, is that my sobriety date on her birthday every year is like, happy birthday. You know, I'm now 5 years sober. Happy birthday. I'm now going to be 6 years sober this year. So I go, and sure enough, it, just like my probation officer in San Antonio had told me, I walk into the office and they're like, no, have a seat and let's talk. And I start going through the motions of explaining what happened about the PI arrest and how I'd like to make it right and all this other stuff. And then I hear them come down the hall, and it's two Travis County sheriffs, and they come in and it's like, can you stand up, please? And I stood up and I went, took you guys long enough. God. And the probation officer that was like listening to me kind of looked at me and I know this. I knew this was going to happen. That was the look I gave her. And so they handcuffed me and took me away. And I went to jail, where I stayed for a month until I found out that I had to do, that I could, what I could do to fix everything, or what my punishment or whatever, instead of going to jail for a couple of years or whatever, for violating felony probation, I would do the SMART program, which I don't know what SMART stands for still. Like the whole time I was in there, they didn't know. They just call it the SMART program, which is ridiculous, but which is a 5-month drug treatment program in Travis County. And it's jail light is what it was. It was like, you didn't have guards. The doors weren't locked, but if you left, it was an automatic felony. You get a automatic felony charge if you left. So you basically slept in glorified closets for, you know, that, and you had six people in a glorified closet with a TV. So I basically spent 6 months in Travis County custody. 6 months locked up. Now, in that program, I developed, because I was in the right mindset, because I went to jail, and I'd been sober, and I knew that I was going to work on myself. So I actually, I kept a journal, and I have no idea where that is. It'd be interesting to read it now. And I just started reading books, and the books in jail are never good, except that it's like all the, you know, like all the Dan Brown books, just, you know, but Da Vinci Code and all that shit. And it's like, have you read Dan Brown's novels? Yeah, I went to jail. But they also had like Shakespeare plays and stuff. So there were some things that I could read that was pretty good. So I basically just dove into reading, and I avoided TV. I just didn't want to. I was thinking in terms of like self-improvement, and I had gotten into Buddhism when I was in rehab the first time in 2011. So I was basically going by memory of the things that I had read about Buddhism that time, and I was thinking about that and trying to figure out how to apply that every day in jail. Like, so I was kind of working on myself through Buddhism in jail, more out of boredom than anything else. So I was like working out and doing push-ups and shit, because that's all you've got. That's really all you have. Just basically working out and doing what little Buddhism study I could. And then I went to the SMART program, which was different, because in the SMART program, you could have your own books. And so the first thing that I did was have my dad sent me my copy of Fight Club, because I had there was something in my head. I had made a joke about how everybody in AA just sounds, they say the same sayings over and over again. You know, keep coming back. It works if you work it one day at a time. And they would say those things, you know, principles over personalities. And then I would want to reply back with rehashing shit from Fight Club, just to, you know, give them a saying right back. Well, you know, it's only after we've lost everything that we're free to do anything. That was just funny to me. But the things in Fight Club, actually, it felt pertinent to me, because it is only after we lost everything that you're free to do anything. And I had lost everything for the second time. I was sitting in jail. I had no job. I had no residence. All my stuff, which was minimal stuff, it's like a laptop and some clothes. It's about all, and a skateboard. That's all I had. My dad had it at his house, just kind of storing it for me. But I really didn't need anything. And I was just, I was starting over. And the thing is that when you don't have anything anymore, you can do anything that you can go anywhere from there. There's nothing holding you down. You know, it's just, all right, we can go. What do we want to do? What can we do? So it was, and I just thought it would be cool, and that's really what it comes down to. I thought it would be cool to use the different aspects in Fight Club, you know, before Tyler Durden starts Project Mayhem and goes crazy about blowing up things. But before that, you know, it's just the concepts of, you know, getting out of materialism and, you know, just the day-to-day, and then I just like that a lot. And there was a section of books that the SMART program had, and we were required to read like three of them. Like everybody had to read at least three or four of these books. And the most popular book, because it was the thinnest one, the one with the least amount of pages, was Miguel Ruiz's
Don Miguel? Is that right?
Yes, Don Miguel Ruiz is The Four Agreements. And so, you know, everyone's like, oh man, that book's great. Not just because it's thin, but also because it's good. So like I got that, and that was exactly what I needed, because The Four Agreements, an agreement basically is everything that you think that you agree that is true because it was taught to you as a kid growing up. Like language, for example, every word in English is an agreement. Like you agree that that's what that word means. And so these agreements are things that you can learn that you're going to agree to do, I guess. And so the four agreements are: be impeccable with your word. Don't take anything personally. Don't make assumptions. Always do your best. And those are easy to remember. It's just four things, and it's easy to remember. Really hard to do, but easy to remember. And also I like them because they don't force morality on you. Like you use your own moral base and your own belief system. This is just making you the best you. You're not trying to convert into any kind of weird thing. It was just so those were so I used those along with the concepts in Fight Club as my base to making myself better and changing the way that I think, because that's really what it is. It's changing thought patterns from your junky thinking and how everything's an angle and where you're kind of a grifter, and instead of looking at everything as an angle and looking at how do I get at something out of this, you change your thought process into something a little bit more productive, and just break out of those cycles of that thought, and that's what you do. And so since I didn't have anything to do for 6 months and 5 months in that program other than these things, I just kept my head down and like worked on trying to change my thought process, and then actually, you know, reading all the stuff, doing all the exercises that they had, and you know, and the different programs and the different like group sessions and group therapy and all that stuff where you like talk it out, and really participating, because we didn't have anything else to do, you might as well participate. So in that program, which was really just full of people trying to get out of jail, we had a lot of drug dealers who were like, oh yeah, I've got a weed problem. So they were in there for weed, and other people who were like, well, no, this is a good 5 month break from that drug I really love, and then I can go back to doing that drug. So there were a few of us who were actually like, no, I'm going to take advantage of this and really actually do something. So that was basically it. Then I got out, and because they wouldn't let me go back to San Antonio. Like, I had to finish my probation. I had just under a year when I got out. But they wouldn't let me go back to San Antonio to do it. And I was scared of being in Austin because that was, you know, all the triggers, I thought, all the places, you know, I didn't want to come. I was scared because, you know, I had so much self-destruction around here. But it turns out it's gone long enough that the dealers were all gone. I didn't know anybody, so I didn't have any connections. And I didn't have to worry about drinking because I really was just... I really drank myself out. Like, I didn't care. I was like, nah. You know, the bars I liked had changed. All the people had changed. Like, it's, you know, the bar stays 22, man. It just keeps going. You know, your drinking buddies have families now. They all moved on. So it was easier than I thought. It wasn't a big deal at all. And I, you know, and then it turned out the biggest thing, though, for me was when I found out that I could actually do stand-up comedy and I could hang out with comedians and go to clubs and go to different shows. Because all it is, you know, you do the show, people don't get wasted at, you know, early on, you know, they get wasted afterwards. And so that was the thing, is I just left. I wouldn't hang out because I was afraid that I was... And it really, yeah, it wasn't as so much being tempted as if I stayed around too long, people started annoying the shit out of me because they were drunk or stoned or something. And I just like, well, I don't have the tolerance to put up with you because I'm completely aware of my surroundings and sober as fuck. So I need to go because I am so irritated right now. So that's really what I did. And you know what? So that's basically how I eventually sobered up. I finally did it. It's really tough because you're weird, because you're socially awkward and you've got social anxiety that you didn't have before because you're completely sober. And every day, like I isolated a lot. Every day got a little bit better, I guess. I got less weird every year. I think it took, after about 3 years of being sober, I was finally able to talk to people, small talk, without going, oh, I hate small talk, like just really hating talking about bullshit. To where it's like, no, I actually like this. Especially now with the political climate, like I said a couple episodes before. Yeah, I love small talk now. I'm like, oh shit, meaningless conversation. Yeah, let's talk about some shit that doesn't mean anything. That has no effect on the world. So it just gets better. It just takes a while. That one day at a time. That's the thing about those sayings. The AAP, the annoying bullshit that they keep saying is all true. So that's the most irritating part of it, is that they were right. So this one's this went a little longer than I wanted, but I knew that it would. I knew that it would. Just I didn't even get into some of the more detailed shit, like what I actually did at rehab, and that's fine. But that's basically what I did, and things are good right now, and I think that they will still be as I move forward. Wow, I am completely out of shit to say. All right, man. Well, thank you guys. Thank you for letting me just talk that out and lay that out there. I hope you found it beneficial. If you have any questions about this, and like serious questions you want, you can email me at stillsoberpod@gmail.com, or even my personal email, the smokepuppet@gmail.com, either one of those. Or if you're a friend of mine on Facebook, you can message me. You don't have to comment on a status, but you can message me directly if you really had something. But I appreciate it, you guys. I'll see you next week. This has been Yes, I'm Still Sober, and I am. I'm John Raven. Bye.
Red wine, a little smoke, a whole lot of loving. That's all I need. Make it through the night. Cold beer, cold shoulder. Just one glass of whiskey. That's all it takes. Knock 'em down.